Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Ben Yeo as our guest. Hi, Ben.
Hey.
Welcome. No, thank you. Thank you for being with us today. In fact, Ben is hosting today. His office is in wonderful Mayfair in London. And it is really an honor to be here with you today, Ben. We've been trying to get together for a while now, and we finally made it happen. So I'm very pleased about that.
Great.
Allow me to make a short introduction, if I may, about yourself. I picked up from your LinkedIn a couple of like taglines that you have: portfolio manager, global equities chair, playwright, angel, sustainability, autism aware. So. But I thought that I'd just dig a little bit deeper and just give people the benefit to learn more about you and all the great things that you're doing. So Ben is Senior Portfolio Manager and Co-Manager of Global Equities. He's a specialist in healthcare and ESG champion at the Royal Bank of Canada. He's also a member of the Investor Advisory Group at the Financial Reporting Council, FRC. He's chair of the Responsible Investment Advisory Committee at Royal London Asset Management. He's co-author of the new textbook on ESG investing by the Chartered Financial Analyst Institute, the CFA UK. And if all of this would not keep you busy enough, you're also a playwright and director and chairman supporting performing arts and theatre companies. And you support autism charity focused on West London. Do you have any time to sleep, Ben?
I sleep really well. Sleeping, eating, moving, those are the three things which actually help you keep really high energy levels. So there are some people who are blessed, seemingly, who don't have to sleep that much, but I definitely like sleeping a lot. So I guess I've always gone along with the adage, which I've had from young, which is if you want something done, you give it to a busy person. Well, I might finish off with the one other thing, if you wanted to add to that list, is I'm part of the advisory group on management commentary for the International Accounting Standards Board's IASB, which is a kind of interesting project on broader reporting. So looking at beyond just the financial statements, but the narrative and strategic reporting, which goes to the front part of the report and accounts.
Fascinating. It's just amazing how much you're doing, and I always feel very inspired, especially, you know, with the kind of the real focus that you have.
Before we continue, a short disclaimer. The thoughts and opinion expressed by Ben Yeo are his alone and do not necessarily represent those of RBC Global Asset Management nor Royal Bank of Canada as a whole, nor are they intended to provide tax, financial or other advice, including recommendations to buy or sell securities. Ben Yeo is a senior portfolio manager with RBC Global Asset Management UK Limited. RBC Global Asset Management, RBC GAM, is the asset management division of Royal Bank of Canada, RBC, which includes RBC Global Asset Management Inc., RBC Global Asset Management US Inc., and RBC Global Asset Management UK Limited, which are separate but affiliated corporate entities.
As a tradition, I always ask people the question, what is impact investing or sustainable investing, perhaps, then, to you?
So sustainable investing or impact investing, I do actually think they're a little bit different. Perhaps I'll start with the idea that currently where we are today, I guess there's a little meme going around about talking about 50 shades of green. So that this is a spectrum of capital, and that perhaps we have to allow that people will be on different parts of that spectrum, different parts of that journey. And you can talk about that spectrum you know, within asset management, you can talk about it within different asset classes. You can talk about it differently within corporates or where you are within the investment chain. And then when you scale it up to thinking about countries and governments and things like that, you can also talk about where you are in terms of as a country on that scale. And here you can actually also start to think about in terms of development about where you might be. A lot of people talk about the global north or the global south and that in equity and also where you are in development. So it's all intersectional within that in terms of sustainability and in terms of impact. And then I think if you look at it apart from where I am or where we're looking at, I guess, relatively mainstream investors, a lot of it starts from the point of looking at the extra financial factors that drive businesses over the long term. So a lot of people start talking about the terminology of intangibles, environmental, social governance, sustainability, sustainable development goals, all of that, but looking for the causal drivers of business which go through to the long term. Out of that, though, you also have a set of people who are really looking maybe even beyond causal, direct causal drivers who are talking about very active stewardship. They're talking about purpose. They're talking about long-term sustainability in those type of ways. And then you've got people who are just thinking about various strategies and implementing that within their own asset management. Then, you know, talking about where you are on the investment chain, it's quite interesting because you have similar discussions at the corporate level. So what does sustainability mean to corporates? Is it simply long-term effects of business model? Again, positive and negatives. Does it tie into purpose? Does it tie into sustainable development goals? A lot of talk about stakeholder capitalism and the like. So you've got that on the corporate level. And then you can flow it down actually onto the individual level. We have obviously protests, we have climate strikes, we have 350, we have the divestment movement. And there's an interesting thing here about the interconnectedness of everything, because we are people, we are the people, we are also employees, we are also customers, we are also voters and all the like because of that. And that means actually we're the same entity. So that's why we as people are putting pressure on governments, putting pressure on pension funds, putting pressure on companies and the like in order to talk about these type of things. So circling back to the original question, you know, what is impact? What is sustainability? I don't think it means the same thing to all people. There are these different shades, but it is trying to point through to thinking about long-term net benefit for the stakeholders involved.
Excellent. The 50 shades of green. That's going to be nice. Maybe actually the title of this.
Maybe the podcast. I think I heard Mark Carney refer to something similar or some other. So it's not an original. It's not an original tagline by me. But actually, that's just pivoting to that, because Mark Carney has spoken about a couple of these things recently, and he was recently speaking at the CFA ESG conference last week, and he was talking about there might be a spectrum of capital within that, and that actually markets will decide. If you are a corporate or an investor who isn't taking into account these things and there is no plan B in your account, so say you're deciding, I'm not going to price for carbon, I'm not going to have any sustainability strategy, I just assume there will be no policy response, then that is something that actually policymakers and people might have to look at in terms of financial stability. And certainly it's an aspect that market participants will be expected to look at. But whether everyone is going to be as dark green looking at solutions, whether some people will be more integrated looking at the puts and takes, and whether some people will be slower, that ultimately in terms of a market reaction would be quite expected.
Perfect. And I'm sure that most people listening know, but Mark Carney is our main man at the Bank of England, and he's been openly talking about it and about the effects of sustainability and the risk of climate affecting the market. So, good point. If we smoothly moved into just giving a bit more information about your company and activities, some of the activities that you do. Again, I always like for people to learn about the different companies that are doing, you know, good things in the market. So in this particular case, we're talking about Royal Bank of Canada, and more specifically about Royal Bank of Canada Global Asset Management. You have, so far, the 30th of September of this year, 354.4 billion of assets under management, 23 investment teams worldwide, and 300 plus investment professionals. And then more specifically as well on RBC Global Equities, which is the area that you look after. You have teams that manages global equity strategies, which includes options of for separate accounts, US mutual funds, Canadian mutual funds, and SICAV Luxembourg funds, if that's the right way to say it. And you currently manage around $10 billion. Anything I missed?
No, that's a very fair summary about the asset management business. I might put it even into perspective on the mothership that is Royal Bank of Canada, obviously headquartered in Canada, one of the largest banks in the world globally. And we are a purpose-driven company. We had a recent meeting, you know, regular town hall, the CEO who recommitted to that purpose. RBC as a whole is going to be committing about $100 billion in sustainable finance over the next few years. We have an aim to give back 1% of our profits back to the communities. And our purpose really is this mission driven of making our communities and clients thrive and prosper. So when you have a purpose like that as a North Star, it is easier for that to flow down into something like asset management, where coming to our own team, we want to make our investors, companies, and societies, we want to make a positive difference to them through responsible long-term investment. And we do that for a variety of clients between endowments and foundations, local governments, corporates, and the like. So we're looking at that. We our main strategy is an integrated ESG one with a lot of deep stewardship and active management, although we do also run exclusionary flavors at that fund, like fossil fuel free and others. A lot about where we sit in terms of integrated ESG and increasingly trying to be more active on the stewardship front is we look at a lot of companies today, in essence, over borrow from a different source of capital. So this is not like over borrowing from the bank, but is over borrowing from your human capital, your environmental capital, natural capital, or an aspect like that. So for instance, you can overborrow from the future by cutting R&D. You can overborrow from the environment by not cleaning up of yourself in terms of natural capital. You can overborrow from your people by cutting staff training and benefits like that. The interesting aspects of those overborrowings is that in the short term, the P&L or cash flow as measured by short-term cash goes up. Say you cut people's salaries or benefits that quarter, you'll actually have more cash coming in the door. But your long-term value is destroyed as you're decreasing your human capital and, quite frankly, all of your best people will leave you. Probably not that quarter. Humans can't move that quickly. But over the following years, probably into next year, you lose all your best people. And now with the informational transparency you have today, you'll find it very hard to recruit. So we want to avoid companies creating what you might call contingent liabilities or liabilities that you don't see on the balance sheet, which are typically extra financial, call them ESG, call them human capital or some other aspect of that. And it's because a lot of that is going to come and crystallize and be a bad thing for you in the future. But if you accept that that's true on the negative side for contingent liabilities, it's almost going to be true as well on the positive side. So you also want to look for companies which are building assets which you don't see on the balance sheet, sustainability assets in your human capital, natural capital, innovation, business model, and the like, because those are going to provide future value for you. And then I guess this is where part of it comes in as a mainstream investor, is that if you believe that a lot of these aspects aren't very well reported on, also they're difficult to measure, the quant machines may be getting there to some extent but might not be there entirely, then that makes an inefficient market for these type of pieces of information, and therefore you should have an alpha or a better risk return associated with that type of analysis. So from that you get this idea that as investors might see, ESG might be an alpha source. This is the idea that you might get better risk and return from looking at these long-term factors as well. But that's one way of looking at it. Obviously, there are others. I would say the second really important point to put on this is this notion of active stewardship, which is coming through. Some people might call this active ownership on this. And this is the idea that particularly in what we would call secondary equity markets, so this is where you're simply exchanging shares between respective buyers and sellers, that might have some impact via price signaling or via a cost of equity or cost of capital type of argument. But actually, you could argue that you might have more of an impact as an owner of that business, persuading the board or the management or that business to pivot to some way which might be how you think might be a net benefit long term. And although we might only have rare examples, you have a company like Ørsted today, which is essentially a wind farm company. It used to be Dong Energy, which was Danish oil and natural gas. So that is a company which has pivoted, and you've got companies within transition. That would be one way that you could make a lot of impact. So there's a lot of debate as to the mechanisms that you might use in order to create value. On active stewardship, sparked by a study by Elroy Dimpson, a professor there and his team, looking at how active stewardship actually adds value in terms of stock prices and also stock returns in terms of things like return on assets and the like there, there's been an increasing interest in that aspect as well of the whole ESG and sustainability landscape.
Excellent. And we'll touch on a couple of the things that you mentioned, and we actually talked about Ørsted when we met with Alan Parry from when he was at Hermes Investment Management, and that was another example. So I know that you've been with the organization for a while now, but is there like a certain points where the focus on ESG and sustainability really ramped up in the last 10 years, let's say, or before that? I mean, you mentioned that you're a purpose-driven company. You mentioned about your commitments, but is there any kind of perhaps lessons or parts of the history that you can share, you know, to inspire others, you know, to move into sustainable investing, other asset managers?
So there is a part of markets which are also interwoven about the values that we have, and because ultimately people are the force which are buying goods and services, the customer or the business, you can see how it's woven into this point of interconnectedness. If I start with my own journey around about this time, I started in this probably a few years into my career, around about 2002, 2003, before this was really called ESG or not. And I was involved with getting together pharmaceutical companies, asset owners, asset managers around HIV drug pricing and access in Africa. And there was a lot of interest at the time because a lot of the pharmaceutical companies didn't realize why they were part of the problem and not part of the solution. So this was one of the really first big collaborative efforts. And from that, my own view or vision came that this should just be a way of doing business, that a lot of this should be net win-win for businesses, for customers, for society, for everyone within that kind of chain. And actually, that whole thing went through for a very long time. I did integrated ESG work. I did responsible investment policy work coming through. But it didn't really catch fire in the imagination, as you alluded to really until a few years ago. And I think this is what we see in some of the society change, then triggering all of this around the investment change. You had a lot of people thinking and talking about this for many, many years, but it didn't really have that same sort of traction. So I guess one piece of advice on that is you have to keep plugging away at it. Sometimes you might get lucky and you ride that wave. Sometimes I guess you might be too early on and you're slightly ahead of your time and thinking. But if you think it's really important, particularly important to your long-term stakeholders, then you've got to stick with it, because it's very hard to predict when some of these things come true. The other aspect I would say is that a lot of this, I think, can be win-win. Thinking about things about growing the pie and growing the pie in a way which makes sense for all. In fact, this is something that you see from Professor Alex Edmonds and his work, as opposed to just splitting the pie both have to be done. But I think if you can think about this in terms of trying to find a lot of more win-win solutions and people coming together and think about the bits that we can agree and move forward, because there's so much to do there, then again, you're talking about this net benefit wealth thing for that. So again, the other thing I would finish on for that is cross-silo thinking and thinking where you can get win-win and bringing people together, I think is still a really important point. And in fact, that's what the collaboration between those pharmaceutical companies and NGOs and the like did go a long way to solving problems in terms of HIV drug access in Africa. And in fact, HIV drugs today still go on the back of beer trucks and soft drink trucks in Africa in order to get access to those more remote villages. So, and in fact, we alluded to this before we started the podcast. That's one idea behind this kind of informal mingle event that I host, where I just get together people actually who think from arts thinkers, from business thinkers and sustainability thinkers, because I think people need to meet together and have conversations and ideas in order to progress things. There's no point shouting at each other in two or three line little missives or tweets all the time. There's actually a lot of places where we could agree or get some agreement about how to move forward and have progress.
Yes, and I kind of stress enough the power of serendipity sometimes when you go to some of these events, you know, where you actually meet, you know, people that you can work with and do incredible things. So I would take advantage, as I just mentioned, that the next Mingle session is on the 14th. So that's a Thursday, I think.
Yeah, 14th of November, yeah. In London. I'm sure we'll provide some links to it, but it will be at Theatre Delhi, yes, at 7:30, which is around Broadgate Circle. And that's actually just after a showing of mine on a sustainability interactive performance show called Thinking Bigly, which is also on November 14th at 6:30, and also November 13th at a lunchtime slot for those who can't make the evening.
And you mentioned, you know, the growth, and then I was going to just double check. So in terms of RBC itself and RBC Global Asset Management, is there any particular point, or was it when you came and joined that you started doing more on kind of ESG and sustainability investing?
So I would speak mainly from the point of view of our own team in terms of global equities there. And this is something that we've always integrated. I think one of the differences has been that the data sets have got better and there's more of them, which has made it more complicated. And so that is something which has evolved over time. Now you have many more different ESG data providers and a lot more emphasis on that. I would say to some extent that most investors who look at deep fundamental investing have always thought about some of these aspects to a degree. And I would say that's true of RBC as well as most other big fund houses have done that. But to the level that you've integrated or made it systematic or raised it into the importance in an organization does vary. RBC Global Asset Management itself is very committed and has been committed for some time.
Excellent. And then you also mentioned about, you know, the kind of the market and how much it's growing and changing. And I take advantage now to mention, perhaps again, but in a bit more detail, that according to the 2018 Global Sustainable Investment Review, which happens to be sponsored by RBC, Hermes and UBS, among others, which highlights that sustainable investing has grown 38%. Up to $30 trillion from 2016 to 2018. In terms of asset allocations, sustainable investment now extends across the range of asset classes commonly found in diversified investment portfolios, mainly focused on Europe, United States, Japan, and Canada, interesting enough. And collectively in these regions, a majority of assets were allocated to public equities. So 51% at the start of 2018. And the next largest asset allocation is on fixed income at 36%. Interesting enough, in 2016, with only Europe and Canada reporting on asset classes allocation, 64% were on sustainable investing assets were on fixed income and 33% on public equities. So it's interesting to see over the last 2 years, how it's changed and how public equities has grown and gained a bigger role. So in terms of,
I would just say on those on those numbers, the CEO of the Principles of Responsible Investing, the UN PRI, Fiona Reynolds was just commenting recently that although they have trillions and trillions who are signed up to PRI, she was unsure to what extent the number of those assets are deeply integrated. So I would just caution a sort of pinch of salt with the kind of trillions dollars. But going back to our first meme about 50 Shades of Green, that it perhaps if you put all of those shades of green, then you do get to that level. And so this is what is interesting when you ask the woman in the street or even different range of stakeholders, because they have a different idea about what sustainability is. Yes. They kind of say, well, actually, it's not all of those assets which are true. What I would say is true is that there definitely is growth. So that's where the change, or what we would call, say, is the delta, even though I don't really know what the absolute percentage of assets are. And the other thing I would concur is that it is spreading across all asset classes, fixed income, public equities, and things like that. Although I would say fixed income is probably a little bit behind public equity still. I think very importantly, though, it's spreading into private markets where, although we've had highlights with a couple of recent examples, particularly in large private market companies, that it's stretching into private equity is quite important because those are very large markets. You can see that the number of public listed public equities entities is actually going down. There are a lot of complicated reasons around perhaps regulation, investor preference, liquidity, and things like that might be driving it. But it is an important aspect to say that we need to be driven into private markets if, at least from the point of systemically and stakeholders and say the planet or people more in general, that would be an important trend to see continue.
Interesting. And talking about investments, I may as well ask you now, where do you see, aside from the trends that you just mentioned, where do you see the opportunities coming up in the coming years, perhaps also including regions that we didn't talk about?
So the opportunity side of the equation, this is really interesting in the sense that if you, again, look at the long cycle of history, we've always had what you might call opportunity sunrise industries or risk or bankruptcy in sunset or risky industries. You had that when we went from here in London, from people who were, in terms of mobility, riding you down the river in a boat. Then it changed to a horse-drawn hackney carriage. Now, then it changed to cars in terms of black cab taxis. Now maybe it'll go to more Ubers, and then maybe it'll even go to autonomous. So in that sense, I think the opportunities are across every single one of our industries and sectors. There are also these type of risks. And you also think in terms of embedded integrated ESG or embedded sustainability. Virtually no company, for instance, is immune to managing human capital, whether that's risk or opportunity from automation or skills or business in those type of senses. So I think actually across every business, every sector, we have opportunity to embed a lot of these ideas. And I think, for instance, even if you just think about climate change or climate emergency, without the intersectionality between inequity, between human capital and all of those things, every single company is going to have to play their part, both in terms of innovation, coming to up with something which can help pivot to a 1.5 to 2 degree world, if we can get there, as well as on the risk side or the consumption side, consuming less intense products, doing different ways of making that. So I think there's going to be a lot. I think maybe if you highlight again, just riffing on climate for one moment, yes, primary energy sources in terms of fossil fuels is certainly a challenge and opportunity. But I think we need to remember that electrification, at least on a global scale, is perhaps only 25% of the problem. You need to think about buildings, industry, mobility, transport, all of those aspects, and the fact that we all need abatement in what we're currently hard to abate sectors like cement, fertilizers, flying, steel making, aluminium, plastics, all of this. So the opportunity is just so wide and vast across everything, plus every single company needs to do something. So that's interestingly when you sit in the middle of something like integrated ESG, you can actually talk to any company and say, well, what's your plan for a 2-degree world? Have you got adaptation? Have you got resilience? Are you innovating? Because actually, I think you'll see it across every company and every sector. Now, thematically, you can weight against certain aspects, like we talked about climate. We've talked about briefly the Sustainable Development Goals, which cover all of humanity to some extent. And to some extent, that's always been some of the things we've talking about. I've looked at healthcare for a long time, improving the quality of human health, improving life expectancy, all of that. Still around today, was around 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. I will posit it will still be around in 10, 50, 100 years' time. So some of these are just about where humans have always placed value. So I kind of, that's a little of a complicated answer, because I kind of feel that
it's very
you
awesome.
Should...
very positive as
well. That doesn't want to understate the challenges that we have, but the opportunities across everything, and we have to get going across all aspects, which is one of the problems about perhaps maybe not necessarily over-focused, but if you're just concentrating on the energy problem, you're not maybe looking at all of the other problems. And I know actually a lot of people are, but they are sort of intersectional. You know, you have announcements and policies of bringing that building insulation for one thing, or mobility and all of these aspects. So I think the opportunities will still be vast, as they kind of always have been, and the risks are always going to be very challenging, actually, as they always have been as well.
And on the other side of the coin, you have the investors, right? And you mentioned you have, you know, mainstream investors that work with you and that allocate, you know, their assets with you. So what do they tell you? You know, what is kind of their mandate? Is it particularly in relation to sustainable investing or certain products, or, you know, certain return expectations or not, you know, so that they can get into sustainable investing? What can you share with us?
So again, actually going back to maybe our 50 Shades of Green, there's a really wide spectrum amongst asset owners, both on institutional and that retail level. So on the one hand, you have investors who find the social political signaling of, say, divesting fossil fuels or the risk for stranded assets for that as being something that is very important to them. Others are really finding that working with transition and active stewardship is really important to them. Some are where integrated ESG is mostly to try and minimize risk or some of these longer term risks. Some are using integrated ESG because, like us, they believe that there's a return opportunity to some degree there. Sometimes it will depend on your outlook in terms of longer term versus shorter term, also in your asset classes. I would say there is a shift to increasing interest over this time, as we alluded to what happens there. And I would say there is, as reflected in a lot of these surveys, a kind of generational shift where if you are very broadly, say, under 40 or more of a millennial generation, this probably is more of increasing importance to you. There's actually some evidence that actually it splits across gender lines as well, at least on the kind of retail woman in the street type of advantage aspect. But we are really talking about a range of views across all of that. And I have to say, there are some people who still remain skeptical. So we talk about this, and particularly within this part of the industry, or say the movement, we kind of think everyone is converted. That is not necessarily the case. Perhaps if you look at surveys, you could say anywhere between 20 to 30% of asset owners into asset managers don't believe this area really is of that much value. Although actually then you're seeing things come through regulation and codes and things like that. UK, we've got the new stewardship code coming out in 2020. That's a big thing. We've got a lot of regulation coming out that part. And then if you look at it again on the person in the street, and where you have some of the surveys, I guess we have a lot of the data here in the US, And roughly, if you look at the surveys, and I think the one I would look at is the Yale survey on climate change perceptions, 30 to 35% of Americans do not believe in man-made climate change. And actually, that's been pretty stable over the last 10 to 15 years. There's slight drift down. In some years, you can get it a little bit lower, but it's still around 30 to 35%. A lot more believe in climate change, but they wouldn't believe in the man-made part. But if you take that as read, and it is quite a consistent signal, that's roughly a third of Americans who really think that the man-made part is not there. Obviously, it doesn't align with the science, but that aligns with where perception is. So I do think we still have to rely on reality on the ground, and position, particularly if you're in a representational form of system, whether that's representational democracy or in terms of pension funds or that, you're representing beneficiaries, and say your beneficiaries are in the US and you've got a slug of that, well, a third of your beneficiaries are kind of like, well, should we really be spending money on that? So it's kind of an interesting type of dilemma you have that. Having said that, I think similar polls, I think you can look at some Gallup polls, around 30 to 40% of Americans still believe in ESP, extrasensory perception and processes like that, and I think 30 to 35% also believe in witchcraft. So you've got a kind of real range of views about what is that. And again, if you're trying to represent all of those opinions, it's a tougher thing for trustees and those who are in terms of those behalfs. Anyway, summing up, there's a big range of views within 50 Shades of Green, and some of those greens would probably still go into brown.
Okay, excellent. We'll leave the some of the neuroscience and witchcraft for another
episode. Go and look it up. Search enough on the internet how many people still believe in witchcraft, particularly in America, but again, the data tends to be done on Americans.
Coming back to the data, you know, just talking a little bit about identifying, measuring impact, and I was going to ask you about your strategy that you focus on. You mentioned integration, exclusion, inclusion, stewardship, engagement, and you mentioned data, that the data is much better now. But do you have any particular methodology or process, you know, that really works for you? I know that, you know, that it could be something you can explain for hours, but that you can share in terms of best practices.
I'll share a little bit on the sort of top line. So we are very bottom-up fundamental investors. So we look at material extra financial sustainability factors, both positive and negative, for every company that we look at. And we have a variety of inputs from several different data providers on this. So we don't rely on one. And this is because if you look at ESG rating providers, the correlation of their ratings is relatively low and all over the place. But we have sort of said that is not necessarily a bad thing for a fundamental active investor. It might be slightly different on the quant side, because we're using those of inputs for our assessments. We're not at a level where we can do this systematically yet. So that's really it. And I think I mentioned before, we're looking for ESG sustainability contingent assets which aren't reflected in the balance sheet or cash flow, and hoping to benefit from the positive side. And we're hoping to avoid companies which have created these type of liabilities, and we're broadly looking to make sure that our companies invested are going to have net benefit to their stakeholders. But those are difficult trade-offs to make, and they aren't ones which I think you can automatically make just by inputting a few things in a model at the moment. They still, at least from our process, require judgment. And that's an interesting thing about if you look at people who are perhaps more exclusionary or perhaps more just on positive impact as opposed to integrated ESG. So on an integrated basis, we're trying to offset the positives and negatives and look at general net benefit to stakeholders, even though we might have a hurdle where we wouldn't go below. Whereas, say, the pros and cons of impact investing, if you can even take aside the measurement and things aside, is say you're a water impact investor. So your thematic is looking at clean water and access to clean water. And say you're looking at, okay, I can get clean water to 500 villages, which might be 200,000 people, and there's a certain return on that. That's something you might do. But you might not, for instance, take into account the carbon cost of that project. And again, I'm making it up, but in extremis, if the carbon cost of that was 1 billion tons of carbon for, say, 1 million tons of clean water, even though you might not have exact read-throughs for that, an integrated investor wouldn't do that, because it's obvious to us in a judgment that 1 billion tons of carbon is not worth 1 million tons of water. So that's the difficulties on the positive, on the impact side. And you can see it on the risk side as well. So you can exclude some negative things, but what are you doing about actually impacting the positive stuff about trying to make active ownership or going for sustainability? And so that, again, is the challenge within there in terms of integrated. You're at least looking at the positive and negatives, but then your challenge is who's to say your judgment is right? Who's to say your materiality is right? Your data isn't there. It's complex. Are you really saying you can make those trade-off judgments? But I would say is if you have enough sophisticated investors looking through that long-term lens, then hopefully as a market, at least, you're getting there. And then that brings us back to potentially one of the purposes within asset management is overall, over the long term, allocating money to good companies, good ideas, good long-term things, and away from bad companies, bad ideas, bad things in the long term. And via, say, at least in the system we have, market forces, you get that. And in a way, that's what sustainable capitalism, and in fact, even sustainable stakeholder capitalism would get you. So you get maximum benefit to your stakeholders over the long term. You can argue about how your assessments or systems to do that, but that's the system that you want to move towards, and you want to move away that capital from bad ideas.
And it is that's the one thing that sometimes we underestimate is the complexity of it all. And at this point, I was going to mention, you know, that you have this event coming up, which is part of your series of ESG Exchange. So this one is ESG Exchange number 6. So the subject is who is responsible for irresponsible business. And I take advantage and promote it because it's happening on the Tuesday, 19th of November, so not long to go. The one thing that I happened to be doing recently was to be watching this documentary on Netflix, which I was mentioning to you offline, called Rotten, which focuses on major global trends in various industries, including some specific products from some specific companies, to be precise. And it highlights corporate and human behavior, which, you know, it all goes related to many things that you were saying, and the impact that it's having in our society, in our planet. There is, for example, on episode 3 of the season 2, it focuses on water and bottled water. And there are, you know, the famous companies that we all know. There was a report that came up in terms of the biggest polluters of plastic bottles, you know, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, and Nestle, right? We all know that. I'm not trying to name and shame, but it's what it is. And the question is, you know, how do we move from kind of ESG reporting the highlights or all the great and good things that we are doing, combined with the fundamentals and growth requirements, to understanding the impact that it's having in the world and on us, right? So this is a bit of a generating awareness from my part, you know, sharing about what is this great documentary is. But then going back to what you were saying, it's super complex. Any of these companies are trying to provide a product or service that supposedly humans want. There is some beliefs that you mentioned before in terms of, you know, what human things are happening and not happening. And then there is also corporate behavior, which sometimes, you see, as I look back in time in my, you know, short history in financial services and working with corporates, is that, you know, I always tend to believe and want to believe that humans don't do things thinking of doing bad things. They just go on to, you know, do the things that they think is best for the corporation and for the customer. And I think that the side effect that's having a lot of negative impact, right? And I just kind of mentioned this to think about, okay, so how do we become more responsible, and how do we deal with the responsibility? You know, I'm guessing that's what's going to be answering the next ESG Exchange event. But any thoughts on that?
Yes. So the ESG Exchange is going to have Colin Meyer, who wrote the book Prosperity, talking about the responsibility of business. And one of his big themes is that he thinks that purpose or corporate purpose is articulated could be one mechanism for that. So his book's very interesting, and he's going to give her a keynote on that thesis. We also have Claire Dichter-Spedding, who works for the National Grid, talking about the opportunities and challenges, and actually also the success that the National Grid has had in decarbonisation, particularly of the UK power grid, and how far we have to go. So those are the two things coming up at the exchange. I think it's interesting taking that, what you said, say plastic bottles and the part of overall responsibility. There's a couple of interesting themes coming there. So one is systems thinking versus personal agency. Another is growth versus a low growth, different growth type of world. So if you think about systems thinking versus personal agency and say plastic bottles as an example, traditionally, I guess corporates haven't been that responsible for their product. Maybe gun makers aside, perhaps tobacco, we have traditionally said, you make the product, it is then government's policy, maybe the consumer, that has more responsibility. So we can think about it in plastic bottles, you can think about it of all the products of fossil fuel, the sort of downstream, they're producing the energy, they're not producing the actual product or service. And so then the debate then is, so take it on plastic bottles is quite an easy one. Should we simply be buying fewer plastic bottles? You can't see it here in the room, but JP has brought his own bottle along.
Can recyclable, don't recyclable. I'm using it all the time. Yeah. It's not.
Exactly. And you have to use that about 100 to 200 times to make up for a plastic bottle, which is all great. But, you know, can you do this via consumer behavior, the demand side, which some thinkers think is around 60 or 70% of the problem? And do you influence that by policy, cultural change, which is a really interesting thing? So that would be perhaps, as we mentioned earlier, the equivalent analogies would be maybe with slavery or maybe with female vote emancipation and things like that, a cultural change aspect which happens. Or do you go to source and say, well, companies perhaps are uniquely placed to do that and to influence people? Plastic bottles, obviously, drinking water definitely has a valuable role in certain circumstances, but have you over-incentivized consumerism? This becomes very difficult because, say, within plastic bottles, or say, very interestingly, within steel or something like that, iron, you're asking companies to promote the idea of using their products less. So are we really in that way? Fossil fuel is another really interesting thing because you do have a company like Shell who said they're going to take into account so-called carbon scope 3, which is the idea that they will take into account the use of their products. But again, you have to speak to people in the industry or even the person in the street and say, that's quite far downstream. What real influence do you have, or what responsibility do you have to the use of your product? The counter would be you are uniquely placed to have the education, the R&D, and the management around that. And those arguments are now happening within fossil fuels, they're happening within plastics, they're happening with overall consumerism. But if it is 60 or 70% the consumer side, whether that's business to business or business to consumer, is it systems thinking that we need, carbon tax dividend, innovation policies and things like that? Is it education and cultural change to produce a new cultural movement, flight shaming, emancipation, slavery, and articulations of that? Is it some mix of that? Because where does the corporate responsibility lie in terms of that or not? Then flowing forward to say, okay, is it systems or is it personal agency, and where those arguments are, you then have that in terms of ideological thinking, which perhaps is actually a little bit more loggerheads than you need. But say you've got Green New Deal ideas about infrastructure, green jobs, you have market forces in terms of carbon tax and dividend. They're not actually necessarily incompatible, and we haven't really tried either to a large extent. And then you can go one further in terms of the intellectual debate happening. You would have debate from what people would call the degrowth movement of economists. Probably most famous would be Kate Raworth, on donut economics, which you could look up. And in the other corner, you would have more mainstream economic thinkers, maybe someone like Tyler Cowen, who would emphasize that actually growth is one of the major ways that we've lifted people out of poverty and things like that. And so that you can't, if you crimp growth, you crimp human development in that sense. And then you have people who are positing. In fact, I think the question was asked of Mark Carney, the Bank of England governor, about this, who said, well, I can envisage a world where you can have low carbon intensity growth. So can you have a way of growth which decouples? Those are all very current debates, right? Between economists, between policymakers, between Green New Deal, between carbon, between systems thinking, between personal agency, between corporate responsibility and all of that. So it's a very interesting melting point at this point of time with quite a lot of pivots in some of these debates. Out of that, I would say the role of the consumer has never been as important as it is. It's always been important, but you have more personal agency than ever before. You have more transparency than ever before. Actually, the role of business has probably never been as important as well. Leadership in that way, how you pivot your businesses, particularly in the large businesses. And again, you can take either side of the argument of that, but Amazon, for instance, have pivoted on a sustainability strategy. I think they've committed to net zero by 2040 and a whole host of other sustainability measures. Again, you can argue about the pace of change, you can argue about authenticity, but you have got one of the largest companies in the world, very endemic in terms of infrastructure and everywhere, pivoting really in what they're saying about sustainability. So that business and where they sit is going to be really vitally and crucially important for where we head. That is partially driven by what they're sensing from their consumers, what they're sensing from their employees, and where they are in the supply chain. So it's interconnected, and a lot of those debates are going to continue. And I think people are going to have to decide where they want to be, maybe in that spectrum of capital, where they're pointing for the future, and if they have any strong views as to whether it should be growth, degrowth, carbon, and where they sit.
Okay. And we didn't talk too much about government and trust in government and politicians and perceptions on that side, but that's for another podcast.
Very briefly say that the interesting thing, if you look at some of the trust barometers, I think Edelman's got a trust barometer.
Yes.
It differs geographically. So yes. Trust, for instance, in I think India and China in their governments is quite high, whereas actually in Europe it's relatively low.
Yeah.
And trust in business, so it's reflecting in a very different
that, I think I saw that coming out the Edelman report about a couple of weeks ago. So yes. And then just very quickly, just wanted to mention that you had done some work internally, and this is a bit of a disclaimer here. You know, we ILA and partners work with them. It's called Impact Tracker, Real Impact Tracker. And you did some internal work to just try to kind of certify in a way, you know, by a third party that you are a very sustainable business on itself. Anything that you can share with us in terms of
some
of the lessons?
You can look that up on the Real Impact Tracker website. This is a website and consultancy which is started by Carrie Krasinski, yes, who's a professor at Yale, amongst other items. And is really looking at businesses like ours, a lens through public policy, a lens through culture, and a lens through investment process to really assess, does he think we're having a positive impact? And so this was the difficulty about the fact that we don't believe that rating agencies can really do that for us as an output income. It really has our input. Mm-hmm. And so Kerry has this system and things, and he comes in, does due diligence, and talks about that, about whether he feels that that process could make positive impact within their framework. Again, it's just another opinion, but it is a deep dive opinion on that. We've had a couple of other opinions from investment consultants, but this is at least an independent one, which this is their focus.
Perfect. So you think it's a positive thing to do, kind of to try to find these, and this is very specific compared to, let's say, a B corporation certification, because it goes more into investment managers specifically
that, and specifically within those aspects of impact, which are, I think, broadly culture, public policy, and investment process. So it's again a different lens, a different way of seeing that.
And just as we're coming to towards the end, I just wanted to quickly ask you about the future and, you know, any thoughts around maybe two parts here. One is, you know, how do we scale? And then on the kind of regulations and reporting side, you mentioned the FRC published, you know, the UK Stewardship Code 2020. They call it, you know, that is the code that redefines stewardship for the 21st century. And it touches on, you know, quite, I thought I'd just take advantage to mention, because it mentions about the requirement to report annually on activities and outcomes, including climate change, across all assets now, including private equity, which you mentioned before. And then signatories need to really explain how their company, in this case, interesting, we mentioned Impact Tracker and everything you're doing inside, then relates to their practice with the stewardship and everything they're doing on the investment side. So how do we scale, and how do we bring more people into the green, into the 50 shades?
How do we scale? That deceptively simple question with a very long, complicated answer. And I appreciate we're running out of time. So my short answer is that you need systems thinking in combination with personal agency. So I think you need both. And if we can nudge some of that systems thinking and combine it with the fact that people can make a difference or feel that they can make a difference, then we can start to scale some of these ideas more. And it started to happen. We can argue about speed and scale and timeframes, but I do think it's clear happening. And policy will definitely play a role on that and see where we go. And the Stewardship Code 2020 is going to be a really important piece of that, because it's putting the onus on a lot of people in the investment chain to report in a much more transparent way and to a higher bar what we're doing in terms of active stewardship. So it's going to work on the chain in that way. So I'm hopeful that is going to raise the bar in terms of what we're looking for on a systems level.
Excellent. So it's a combined effort by all the stakeholders, rather than just that asset owners or the investment managers driving it versus the politicians or the other people.
Right? Yeah. And I mean, I would go further than that. So it's corporates, it's businesses, it's everyone. We're all going to have a part to play in it.
And I didn't want to finish without just talking a little bit more about you, because, you know, I read, you know, a little bit more about what you have done in your life so far, and I found it fascinating and inspiring to see your kind of your own personal evolution. I saw your family is originally from Malaysia, if I'm correct, and then I noted that you won a scholarship to attend Westminster School. You studied sciences at Cambridge. You know, we focus on neuroscience. Then you went to Harvard University as a, what is it called, Herschel Smith Scholar, studying dramaturgy and playwriting. What inspired you to become this portfolio manager and ESG champion? If I had one, it was it one person, was it one event, or maybe just to mention, you know, somebody that inspired you through your life that perhaps had that impact. And I don't know if religion had anything to do, by the way, that's the other thing, because you went to that school.
I can only have a very short answer to that. I would have been very fortunate in my lifetime to have very many great teachers and mentors. No one ever achieves anything by themselves. There's probably too many to call out, but certainly some at Westminster School, teachers there, maths teacher, chemistry teacher, all of that. Into Cambridge, my psychology teacher there, very influential. Did more neuroscience at Harvard, and then had a very brilliant playwright teacher, dramaturgy teacher, poetry teacher, and then into even working life. And I guess, you know, one, you know, tiny personal on that is you should try and, I guess, do you choose your friends and do you choose your mentors? Do they choose you? It's a little bit of both, but having friends who can support and challenge you, and the same with your mentors and teachers. I believe strongly in the power of connections, and that is definitely a really important aspect.
Fantastic. One last call to action, and how can people get in touch with you? Or
A really good way of keeping in touch with me is via LinkedIn. So there's my LinkedIn profile there. If you want to hear about some of my wider thoughts, I do keep a personal blog at thendobetter.com, and do run this Mingle, which is open to all. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ben, for your time. And it's bye for now until our next episode of Impact Leaders. Please remember to check our partner's website for upcoming events. Thank you.
Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.